The Girlfriend Bracket is brought to you by Gathering Magic and CoolStuffInc.com. Now, one of the reasons that I love Cool Stuff Inc. is because of their rewards program, which you become a member of just by making a purchase. After that, every purchase you make pushes you towards another level of the program, which means even more savings. Right now, I'm on level 6, which means I save 8% on all of my magic singles and 2% on booster boxes and board games. So head on over to CoolStuffInc.com and start saving money today. Hey, squirrel friends, welcome to episode number 17 of the Girlfriend Bracket. I am Erin.
I'm Hallie.
And I'm Chris.
Now, you may have noticed that we are one person short tonight. Katie is in Washington, D.C. on vacation with her family, so it's just three of us, and I think we can hold down the fort.
Yeah, we can do it.
There will be a noticeable absence of Lumpy Doodahs, but otherwise, I think we're good.
I don't know. I think we have enough Lumpy Doodahs for everybody, just saying. Yeah, we did have a guest in mind, but unfortunately there were some scheduling conflicts. They will actually be joining us next week when Katie will be back and we can all hang out on the show together, so be sure to tune in for that. All right, let's go ahead and get started. So our shout-outs this week, we have a brand new review on iTunes. And this one is coming to us from Acid Beaver. Acid Beaver gave us 5 stars and called us awesome. Said, great magic podcast for listeners of any gender. Thank you so much for that, Acid Beaver. Our woman of excellence this week was actually suggested to us by a listener named Zach, who sent us a lovely email about this woman, and we will tell you all about her. Her name is Asuka Joy Goss. I'm sorry if I pronounced that wrong. And Zach says that Asuka helps her community by putting people in touch with their favorite artists and getting them like signatures and altars and prints and things like that. And while she was doing that, Asuka heard that an artist named Cyril Vanderhagen was going through, he was ill and he was dealing with medical bills. To help him with that, Asuka decided to get in touch with other artists and was able to work out fees and some of their fees going towards Cyril's medical bills, keeping none of the money for herself. It all went to him and his cause. And she called this effort Signatures for Support. And so far, Asuka has raised between $800 and $1,200 towards Cyril's medical bills. And Zach thought this was amazing and thought we should know about it. I think it's amazing. And if you want to continue to support Asuka, you can send her an email at signaturesforsupport@gmail.com. It's the number 4. You can also make donations through PayPal at the same address. And I think that's fantastic.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome. Really cool.
All right, so let's go ahead and get started. So, Hallie, you were able to play some magic this past weekend, yeah?
Yep. I went to a PPTQ at Mock's Boarding House, and it was modern. I got there just in time because there were 107 people in the tournament.
What?
Yeah, it was, I think it's the biggest PPTQ we've had in Seattle so far.
Wow.
Yeah, I played Grixis Delver, and this was probably my 5th time playing it in a tournament. I didn't do super well, but I got a lot more experience with the deck, which is great. I spent a lot of time practicing my Merfolk matchup with a friend of mine, because Merfolk was surprisingly popular at this PPTQ. It made the top 8. And one thing I learned was that, you know, even though I kind of took to the deck pretty quickly because I've played Delver decks before, Grixis Delver is not an entry-level deck. Like, it requires a lot of very precise sequencing, and there were a lot of matches, like, against Fish and against Tron, even against Affinity, that I felt like I was, you know, maybe one turn away from closing out the game, and if I had just, you know, sequenced my spells a little bit differently, like, gotten Pyromancer triggers on a previous turn, I probably would have won, but instead I gave my opponent an opportunity that I probably shouldn't have. I would recommend this deck to people who like playing tempo like I do, but with the caveat that it requires a lot of practice, and it's a challenge that I think I'm up for, but it's probably not for everyone.
Now, let me ask you this, because you said that you have experience playing Delver decks, so does that not, has that not helped you in any way? Like, is this a totally different beast than other versions you played with?
It is different in that it definitely has a different late game plan than some other Delver decks that I've played. Like, you have to sort of balance between, like, figuring out when to shift gears from being really aggressive to, okay, I'm going to land a Tassiger or an Angler and try to ride this to the finish. I think that's definitely a concern. Like, I've definitely had to keep track of my graveyard a lot more with this deck than I have with previous Delver decks that I've played. But I think one thing that's different is that I've played with Delver and Snapcaster and Burn spells quite a lot. I don't have a ton of experience playing with Young Pyromancer. And so, like, keeping track of that damage and keeping track of all of those triggers is still fairly new to me. And so I guess that's a little bit of a different flavor that I kind of need to get used to.
Now, you mentioned what some of your difficult matchups were. What would you say that you're good against?
I've heard that the Tron matchup is pretty good, especially because we have Blood Moon in the sideboard. And there were several matches against Tron that I won because I was able to Blood Moon them. And there was one match against Tron that was pretty crazy, where I basically had lethal on the board and my opponent Emrakul'd me, and I almost survived, like, being hit by Emrakul. I was at 19, I think, because I had only fetched once. And, or I had gained life off of their Grove or something. And my opponent attacked me with Emrakul, and I just took it and sacked all my lands because I had enough elemental tokens and, like, a Delver and a Pyromancer and, like, a bunch of small creatures that I could deal lethal with. But my opponent won because he was able to play a Chromatic Sphere and then Nature's Claim his own Chromatic Sphere to gain 4 life. So a lot of the matches that I played were very, very close like that.
That's interesting. I admit that I'm somebody who, when I see a Delver deck, it does seem like it's not that it's easy per se, and maybe it's just that I'm watching people who are so good at it, but it just seems kind of effortless. Whereas, I admit that when I see other decks, they look like they're more difficult to pilot.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that I remember Reed Duke wrote about when he wrote an article maybe a year or two ago about Legacy. And this is an article that I reference a lot because I think it was really good and, like, encapsulates Eternal formats really well. He says that there are decks that are difficult to play because they require you to know how the deck works. You know, that's your dredge decks, your other combo decks. And then there are decks that are hard to play because, you know, the individual cards aren't that difficult to wrap your head around. Like, everyone knows how to flip a Delver. Everyone knows how Snapcaster Mage works. But it's knowing your matchups and knowing your metagame that's tricky. And to be honest, I still am just sort of starting to learn how to play Modern. And even though I know how all the cards in my deck work, it's a matter of, like I said, sequencing and knowing, like, when is the best time to cast these certain spells, or, like, which land to fetch, so on and so forth, how to manage my life total. That's the actual tricky part.
Sure. Chris, did you play any Magic? Oh, you can?
Yeah, because, like, now that I finally have Snapcasters, I'm trying to learn how to play with them. I'm trying to tell myself, well, when's a good time, you know, to flash in a Snapcaster? What spell should I be targeting with this? Does this help me in any way? And that's one thing that's been kind of not difficult for me to learn, but just interesting to try to learn the real versatility of what that particular card does. And even with thinking about trying to, if I wanted to get into Legacy to play Miracles, that deck would be difficult for me to pilot, even though there's things in there I would understand. I would definitely want to have a lot of practice with it before I would ever take it anywhere. There's just so much involved with it.
Yeah, and there are some skills that are transferable, obviously. Like, whenever I am the beatdown in a matchup playing a Delver deck, I pretty much know what I'm doing. Like, I played against Esper Control in this PPTQ in the first round. And, like, I have played Delver against blue-white X control decks before. And so I know how that matchup goes. I know how to press my advantage. I know sort of the ins and outs of that matchup. And, you know, I can transfer that to any format. Like, if I've played Delver in Legacy before, and if I play against Miracles, I know exactly how that matchup goes. I know how to sort of get ahead and stay ahead, which is the important sort of macro thing to know when you're playing a deck like that.
Yeah, I can relate to that. You know, there are definitely, so when I started playing Legacy Dredge, I looked back at Loam Pox, which I'd been playing for a month or two, and realized that I was playing it kind of wrong. And when I picked up Loam Pox again, I feel like I was able to play it much better because of the time that I spent playing Legacy Dredge. With that said, though, I think that Legacy Dredge is a lot easier for a Dredge player because you're just dredging. You don't ever mm-hmm. want a normal draw if you can possibly help it. And with Loam Pox, there are times where you do want a normal draw because you do have Go for the Throat in your main deck and you do have Abrupt Decay or Terminate, things that you can't just cast from your graveyard. Whereas with Legacy Dredge, 90% of what you do is with your graveyard. So you don't care if you know, have to just dredge yourself stupid, so to speak. And that's the main issue I have with Loam Pox right now is when I play Legacy Dredge, it does feel easier. Whereas with Modern, it's like, ooh, do I want to try and gamble and see if maybe I dredge something useful? Do I want to try to top deck and see if something comes up? And that's where I'm having the issue. But I understand, you know, learning things between decks that might be the same.
Right.
Chris, did you play any Magic this past weekend?
I did not. I knew I was going to have to get up super early for work Saturday. So when I do that, I sometimes have to forego Magic. Even though I have to do that this weekend again, I'm still going to go play Modern. I should have the cards, the remaining cards that I needed for my Scred White and Blue deck. So I'm hoping to take that to Modern to get FNM to get more practice with it. So I'm pretty excited to finally have all the pieces at my disposal to finally be able to play this deck I've been building for like 2 months.
Is that your Swan's deck?
It is. So I'm like, yay, I can't wait because I've been playing with it proxied there. And people are like, what you doing? And I'm like, they're like, oh. And they see the Swans are like, oh, set and Scred. And okay. So I'm like, yeah, I can't wait to actually try to see how it does against Tron, how it does against Twin, other things just to kind of get more experience with that and more experience with the deck. And if I like it, you know, I'll take it to a tournament or something. If not, I'm just acquiring more cards to build other decks, give new things a try. So I'm just psyched about getting everything together finally so I can play it with non-proxied craziness.
Sweet.
I played an FNM the other day. I was going to play. I found out there was a 1K in the area at a very small gaming convention that nobody really advertised. Like, I belong to two different Facebook groups for our Milwaukee community, and I don't recall seeing this event mentioned at all. It was Modern, and had I known about it, I would have definitely gone. It was the same morning that I scheduled a vet appointment for my cat that she didn't even need because she's fine and she's a jerk. I was so indignant about it. It's just like, I missed a 1K for this. I was livid. But I did play FNM. I faced two token decks back-to-back, which is really unusual for me. The first deck was my friend John, and he was playing Esper Control, but the win condition was Secure the Wastes. So he was like a normal Esper Control deck, and all of a sudden he would just, at the end of his turn, he'd be like, make 9 tokens. And you're like, what? And then he would just Snapcaster Mage another 7 tokens. And it's like, ugh. And main deck Zealous Persecution, which of course is very good against Loam Pox because I have a lot of 1 toughness creatures. And it made it difficult to sideboard against him because it's like, well, you're a control deck, but you've also got creatures. So I can't. Okay, so I maybe need some more Dark Blast, but I don't want to discard, do I? And I didn't know what to do. Very close games. And then game 2 was a newer player. Like, he had just purchased the Modern event deck. And he was playing very carefully, very slowly. And game one, he beat me. Game two, I beat him. We went to game three, and it was just, two honor the pures. I didn't see any of my ray of revelation. And I was like, oh, this is a bummer. And he was a new player. Couldn't be mad at him. I let him have a good time. After that, I went to Trader Joe's, bought $15 worth of snacks, and had a gay old time.
Sweet.
So there were three events that happened this past weekend. We're going to start off at GP Buenos Aires. This was standard, and Pascal Maynard won the whole damn thing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that foil Tarmogoyf was the right pick after all, right?
I am loving that Pascal sort of, on this high right now, and that he, is becoming known for something other than that incident. And all the players who said, I know they apologized and everything, but all the people who were like, "You're bad for the game, you're a dishonor," you're eating off of his plate right now, and you're gonna love it. And I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, he was playing Abzan, which is arguably probably the best deck in standard right now. So, I mean, good for him. It seems like he had a good weekend.
Did you see the picture of him in the top eight profiles? Okay, so you know how they always do the top eight profiles where they take that professional-looking picture of them and they ask them, like, what is your age and where are you from and what is, So in his picture, he's holding up a makeshift sign that says, "I'm coming for you, Alexander Haine."
Now I
Love
have to go
it.
see this.
Yes, it is great. But I'm all for it. So the noteworthy decks that I noticed, I was going through the top eight deck list in the top 32. There was a mono red dragon aggro. And this was interesting to me. I'd never seen this before. So it was four Monastery Swift Spear, three Zergo Bellstriker, three Eidolon of the Great Revel, four Flamewake Phoenix, four Thunderbreak Regent, and four Stormbreath Dragon. This looks dangerous.
Yeah, that's a pretty good curve.
Yeah, I certainly don't want to be facing this. The other deck that I found interesting was Naya Mastery. This is what we're used to as being green white mastery, but with a touch of red.
Yeah, I saw that one too. I was like, that could be maybe fun.
I was also excited about the 19th place. There was a teamer deck which had three Xenagos the Reveler, three Sarkhan Unbroken, Savage Knuckleblade, a playset of those, Thunderbreak Regent, Stormbreath Dragon, and then things like Crater's Claws, Stubborn Denial, and Reality Shift. That's the
Oh.
one in a blue, exile a creature, and then that controller manifests the top card of their library. All sorts of teamer spice and goodness there.
Yeah, I hadn't seen Reality Shift, but I remember a couple weeks ago I was watching like a Star City Open or something, and there was someone who was playing Teemer Dragons in Standard, and the reason he wanted to play Teemer was because he felt Stubborn Denial was really good in this meta. And I think like in that shell, especially when you have like Thunderbreak Regent and Savage Knuckleblade, like that turns on Stubborn Denial really easily.
Yeah, I would like to see Teemer achieve a little bit more success. I think that's the only wedge, if you will, that hasn't really taken off. You're like, Mardu's had its day, Abzan has certainly had its day, Sultai has its day, depending on the day. And Teemer's really the one we haven't heard much from, so I'm all for this.
Yeah, definitely.
There was also an aggro green devotion deck that took 15th place that I thought was pretty cool. This was all green, all awesome. And there were some interesting cards in there that I don't usually see in a lot of decks, like Servants of the Scale. I don't think I've seen that since like a pre-release. Using a two aspect of Hydra, a Swordwise Centaur, Avatar of the Resolute. I was just like, that's pretty cool. Like, I like this. And then for a lot of decks, it seemed like a lot of people were favoring Self-Inflicted Wound in their sideboard. And a Johnny Mentor of Heroes, and I thought that that was pretty interesting that Self-Inflicted Wound is getting some more play.
Yeah, it's super good right now. It hits all kinds of creatures. Actually, I test with a red deck player, as I've mentioned before, and there were many times when he kept asking me if he should like splash black just so he could play Self-Inflicted Wound in his sideboard, because it gets rid of like just about anything that Roast gets rid of and more, except for maybe Tassigur. But Yeah, he like it's a really good sideboard card right now, I think.
And there was Mob Rule.
What? Where was what deck had Mob Rule in the sideboard?
It was a Mardu Dragons deck.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm looking at this Green Devotion deck, and it's Avatar the Resolute, Reverent Hunter. That's the one where when it enters the battlefield, you put a number of counters on it equal to the devotion to green.
Yeah.
Servant of the Scale, Swordwise Centaur, the 2 green 3/2, and 1 copy of Temur Charger. Like, I like this. I think this is a nice take on mono green. It's certainly a little bit different than the usual, make a ton of mana, make a really big Genesis Hydra, make a really big Polykronos. Like, I like this. I would play this.
Yeah, I want to say Kibler played something like that in the Standard Super League 1 week. I don't remember.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I wish they had shown coverage of GP Buenos Aires. I don't think that they did. There was quite a few people, I think, on social media asking Wizards if there would be coverage or why it wasn't there.
I don't think Singapore had it either. And I know Singapore's is one I really would have wanted to see, which we'll get to in a second. So GP Singapore is next. This one was Modern. The winner, it looks like Affinity was the big winner this weekend. There was Affinity in the finals. The top 32 was full of Affinity. What do you all think about that? Because for a while there, people were calling Affinity, they were saying that it wasn't so great right now between Kolaghan's Command. That card was everywhere. And they were just saying, you know what, we think it's a bad time for Affinity. Like, did you agree with that? Or are you surprised by this at all?
I mean, Kolaghan's Command is quite good. Like, you pretty much get a 2-for-1 every time you cast it against Affinity. But the thing is, sometimes, I guess it depends on their draw. Like, sometimes by turn 3, they mount a large enough board state that you can't really deal with it. Or, if they're on the play turn 3, they land an Etch Champion and you can't do anything about it. Like, I can definitely see it. Like, the decks that run Kolaghan's Command don't run that many copies. Like, I remember I played against Affinity this past weekend, and I never, I had 2 copies in my deck and I just didn't see them and I got smashed. So I think, like, the raw power of Affinity is still there, definitely.
Yeah, I faced a lot of affinity decks at the PPTQ that we went to 2 weeks ago. So I think it's definitely making a comeback. Maybe there's just people that just favor the deck in general. Think it's maybe a good time to start playing it again. But I mean, it definitely wrecks me whenever I have to deal with it. So good for that.
You said your friend Morgan did well with that deck too, right?
Yep, it was a 6-round PPTQ. She was 5-0 going into round 6. She was able to draw into the finals, and then she won her first finals. I think they call those the quarters. Yeah. So she won the quarters, and then she got to the semis, I believe they're called. I'm such a bad competitive player. And then she lost to that Zubern hybrid. So she finished in third place. Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah,
third.
she did that with Affinity.
Yeah, and I think I mean, it's been said for a while that Modern is a deck that really rewards people who know their deck, not necessarily people who metagame well. And I think, it's obviously a combination of the two, but I think that's still true for the format. I think, you still see Patrick Dickmon putting up great results with Temur Twin. So it's the kind of thing where, if you have a deck that you have practiced for a really long time, it makes sense to stick with it instead of just going with whatever the hot new thing is.
I have to say I'm a little concerned because I've seen some people talk about this card from Origins. I can never remember the name, but it's like 2 and a blue, and it's like a time twister effect. And Craig Wesko had sent a tweet out with an example hand from Affinity, including that card, and he was like, "Keep or snap keep?" And I'm like, "No, no, no!" Like, I don't want to imagine Affinity vomiting out their hand, playing that card, having 7 more cards, and I'm just like, oh, like I really worry that that card's going to be trouble.
Yeah, I remember when that was spoiled. I was just like, okay, how soon until this gets banned in Modern?
Yeah. Some other interesting decks that I noticed from the top 32. A Little Kid Junk made its return with the Wilt Leaf Liege and the green white aggro shell. Blue white control. This made me think of you, Chris.
Yay.
Let me find the list here because it made me think of you. It had a lot of cards I'd never seen. I haven't seen in modern before. So we have four Wall of Omens, four Kitchen Finks in the main, two Vendilion Click, two Restoration Angel, a Dragon Lord Ojutai, a Sun Titan, a Consecrated Sphinx, one Pact of Negation, three Detention Sphere, Gideon Jura, and then some of the other usual suspects. This is up your alley, Chris.
I know, I was reading the list. I'm like, yeah, okay, oh, that too. I could play this. Like some of the cards I had from my, God, what was it? Esper Gifts deck, because I was like Sun Titan, Wall of Omens. I'm like, okay. So yeah, I could probably like whip that up in no time.
Yeah, I think that if Swans doesn't end up working for you, there's still, I think that you have enough cards that are easily transferable where you could go like, okay, if Swans isn't working, I'll just try Grixis control, I'll try blue white control, and you might be able to find the one that you like.
Yeah, I even played against an Esper control deck that I thought was really cool at the PPTQ. This person was also playing Dragon Lord Ojutai, but he was playing Silumgar's Scorn. So he's playing Silumgar's Scorn with Dragon Lord Ojutai, and he was also playing Nameless Inversion because it's a tribal instant shapeshifter, so he can reveal it as a dragon to make it counterspell instead of whatever the other one is. Yeah, so it seemed pretty cool.
I was kind of excited about the four color Coco deck that made the top eight.
The one with Kiki Jiki.
Yeah. There was just like some crazy stuff going on in there, a lot of little one ofs and stuff and other randomness. And I was like, for some reason, I like this. And then, of course, it was four color, so I thought of Katie.
Oh, Katie, we miss you. Yeah, I've seen Jeff Hoagland piloting something like this for a while, and he thinks it's great. And it reminds me a lot of company decks in general just remind me of Birthing Pod, and this one in particular reminds me of Kiki Pod, because you have Kiki Jiki is a Snapcaster, Deceiver Exarch, elements of Splinter Twin, but yet you also have the smaller elements like Fauna Shaman, Eternal Witness that remind you of Birthing Pod, and I certainly don't want to be facing this.
Yeah, it might be a bad time.
Did you hear the story about Reed Duke and him making top four?
I saw he made top four, but I did not hear the story. I saw he was playing Jund too.
So apparently, and he talks about this in his top eight profile, he was supposed to play Grishelbrand, which is the Goryeo's Vengeance, Grizzlebrand, Nourishing Shoal, Boborigmos that's become rather popular, and he lost his deck on the plane. So
No.
he was like, I'll just play Jund. I know Jund. It's my backup deck. And then he just makes top four, like you do.
Just casually make top four on the other side of the country.
No thing. Like if that were me, I would be just this pile of nervousness and stress. Like, where's my deck? I planned for this deck. I have a sideboard guide for this deck. What am I gonna do? Like I wouldn't be able to come back like that. I'd be eating my weight in Reese's peanut butter cups just from the anxiety. And he's just like, no big, I'll play Jund, and here he is.
Awesome.
Yeah, we love Reed. Any other decks that you enjoyed from Singapore?
Teemer Delver looked like it was pretty cool.
Did it have Hooting Mandrills?
Hoot hoot.
Don't underestimate the mandrills, man.
I was taking a look at that deck. It seems like it had a pretty cool sideboard plan. Like being able to play like Ancient Grudge and Destructive Revelry is pretty cool. But I think I'm gonna stick with my Anglers, my Tassigers, and my Terminates.
You don't believe in the hoot hoots?
I don't know. They're not really for me.
Yeah, I'm
I don't know.
looking
When
at the
people
deck.
get them out, it's a bad time.
Yeah, I'm looking at the list right now. It's four Tarmogoyf, four Delver, four Hooting Mandrills, all in on the Hoot Hoots. And
Hoot
then, is this going to be our new Lumpy Doodahs, by the
I
way?
have no idea. Someone has to bring the comic relief when Katie's not here.
And three Stubborn Denial, two Disrupting Shoal, that's spicy, two Simic Charm in the main. And this is fun.
It is definitely fun. I like Simic Charm. I like the versatility. But yeah, it seems like a pretty cool deck. I've seen a couple of people talking about Teemer Delver, so I think Delvers of all flavors are more than welcome in Modern these days.
Sure. Last event that we're going to talk about is SCG Baltimore, which was standard. Andrew Boswell won the whole thing. Congrats to him.
Yeah, I was watching him when he won, and like they were just like so happy for him, and everyone's just like flipping out about him winning because it was his first open win, I believe.
Yeah, we're big fans of the boss here. I couldn't help but laugh at his tagline, something like "When the sun's out, guns out."
What?
Very appropriate.
He means because of his arms, because he has a penchant for wearing sleeveless shirts.
Ah, yeah.
So when it gets cold out, they notice, people notice that a lot of times he'll wear a hoodie or something, but if it's nice out and the sun is out, he brings the guns out.
Ah, gotcha.
He's
He
so
loves
much
that
fun.
Toy Wiz shirt.
He does. I love that. I love seeing players have, like a brand that they stand by or an outfit that they rock or a hat that they rock. I think that's wonderful. Among the decks that I noticed at the SCG Baltimore, Mono Red Goblins, which I know.
Gobelisk, yeah.
Gobelisk, yeah, we called that
Gobelisk,
one. That was
yeah.
Saito who called that one, yeah.
Yeah, it was a while ago.
I think at
Yeah,
one point they had out like two or three like Obelisk of Urd. Like they weren't drawing into anything like crazy stuff, but he was like, I gotta go, I gotta go, I gotta like get through this to win. And he was just dropping obelisk after obelisk, and I was like, how many is he gonna have out? Like all four or something? But it was entertaining.
yeah, the list that I was most interested in was Mono Black Soldiers. That one came in 13th, and that has cards like Bloodchin Rager, Bloodsoaked Champion, things like that. Some of the Mardu dash creatures, the black ones, there's the one that, the opponent loses life, and there's the one that makes a 2/1 soldier token. I would actually play this deck. Like, I'm thinking of sleeving this up for SCG Chicago because I can't really get it up for standard, and it's black. It seems like it's easy to pilot, so I think it costs like $30 to build.
Yeah,
Self-inflicted wounds.
it's pro I think I looked it up and it's like $10 on Magic Online or something.
Yeah, I think the most expensive card was Thoughtseize, which I of course have a play set of because I am a black mage, but I don't know. I think I might throw this together for FNM this week and just see if I can turn the card sideways and see what happens.
I actually have a couple friends who have played Warriors, like Black White Warriors in Standard recently, and it seems like just kind of like a streamlined version of that with like a little less reach, but a little more consistency. And so I think it has potential.
I was wondering if mono black was the way to go or black white, because I was on Happy MTG, which Chris, I know you love and you watch their stream, and I had seen a lot of black white lists there with those chiefs, the ones that give like warriors plus O plus one or plus one plus O, and I couldn't help but wonder which one was better.
If you want a Warriors list, Robert has built Warriors. He convinced Kale to play it. He convinced a couple of our other friends to play it. And so they've all brought it to a couple of FNMs and done like reasonably well with it. I think Kale went 4-0 at FNM with it like a month ago or something. Yeah, I think it's a totally reasonable deck. And yeah, if you want recommendations, I can definitely send some your way.
Mono black?
For Warriors.
Yeah, but were they on black white or just black?
It was black white.
Yeah, send it over. I mean, we've got like what, 3 weeks to prepare?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm all for it. So.
Yeah, someone was playing it last night and I thought of you. I'm like, oh, I'm like, Aaron might like that. And I think that they were playing versus a green red devotion player that had, and I don't know if it's Alesha, I just like to call her Allie. In the main deck, and I'm like, that's really cool too. So I saw some good stuff last night.
Nice.
Yeah, the other thing I was impressed with regarding SCG Baltimore was the Legacy 5K. Dredge came in third.
Yay.
Very excited. His list was a little not what I'm used to. I mean, I haven't been playing long enough to really critique it, but there were just a couple of choices where I was like, huh, it's very interesting that he would have that in there. But that gave me some hope because I'm planning on playing Dredge at the 5K in Chicago.
Yeah, sweet. One thing I thought was interesting about the top eight at SCG Baltimore in the standard portion was just like where all the dragons went, you know, because we were talking, I think, on the last show about how there were all these dragons, like all these green-red dragons decks everywhere. And I was looking through the top eight, and it was just like, you know, Abzan aggro, Jeskai aggro, Gobelisk, Mono Red Devotion, like it's kind of all over the place. Lots of decks that we haven't seen in a really long time, just making a good showing. It was kind of surprising.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the cause is, but I think it's a good sign for Standard. You know, it's nice to know that you can, you know, maybe you can play what you want to play and still have a chance at doing well. And I think we've seen that. I think it's been like that every week. Like, I really don't think we've seen a deck consistently dominate. I mean, Abzan Control has been around in various forms, but I think that in terms of like the deck of the week, the deck that gets all the attention, I think that's changed from week to week.
Yeah, I was actually put out some feelers on Twitter because I was thinking about doing a 4th of July stream this coming weekend. And so I asked people, you know, is Jeskai aggro any good? I haven't played Standard in a while. I've just been like drafting and I've been building a cube. Like that's been consuming my whole Magic time. So I was just like, you know, is Jeskai aggro good in Standard? And a whole bunch of people were just like, nah, I don't really know. But now that I've seen it do well in a tournament, I mean, obviously, I don't want to be super results oriented and be like, oh, it did well in a tournament, it must be good. But, you know, I wouldn't be opposed to, like, sleeving it up on Magic Online and, like, playing in a couple tournaments with it this weekend if it's, you know, for the purpose of providing some 4th of July entertainment for my viewers.
Are you going to wear a big Uncle Sam hat?
I don't have one, but I could probably get one by then.
I would love to see that.
Yeah.
That'd be great. So, spoilers. There are more and more MTG Origins cards coming out every day, and I feel like we've all finally seen spoilers or seen some cards that we are excited about and that we want to play. Chris, why don't you go first? What cards are you excited about?
Let's see. I had a few that I was excited about. I think that Send to Sleep is a pretty good blue card that looked awesome to me. Clash of Wills, it may not be as baller as Syncopate, being able to exile their card that you're countering, but still awesome. Days Undoing looks cool for a lot of different reasons. So I kind of want to maybe play with that, see what happens. I know a lot of people are talking about Hallowed Moonlight and how that can wreck Twin and other things, so that might be good to have for Modern. Disciple of the Ring looked cool, and Talent of the Telepath.
Yeah, Hallowed Moonlight I think is going to be fun against the Coco decks.
Yeah, that too. Any kind of hate for that, like if I can help it, like if it's still a thing by then, I would definitely like to have more in my sideboard for it. With Blue-White, I wasn't as concerned about it. I guess I'll have to see how my new deck pans out, but I wasn't really that worried about it whenever I'd face it.
I think if you're running main deck Anger of the Gods, you're going to be okay.
Well, I'm going to up it, I think, from 2 to maybe 3. I got to tweak some stuff with the mana base for sure, because it relies too much, it feels like, on fetches. And while I know that they're good, I feel like I need to fix something with that.
Yeah, I know somebody also brought up Hallowed Moonlight against Living End, and I was like, you shut your mouth! I was like, no, you will not use it against Living End. And I'm like, oh, no.
It's like, shh, don't tell anybody.
Right? Like, if we just don't talk about it, it's not happening. Just, nope. You don't need to use it against Dredge. No, you don't have to exile my Icarids and my Bloodgate. No, it's terrible. Don't even think about it. Hallie, what are you excited about?
I'm excited about Languish, because I have missed Mutilate for a really long time, and I'm so glad that Black has a 4-mana more or less board wipe again. Like, that's pretty sweet. So I like Languish. I'm glad to have Goblin Piledriver back. It'll be interesting to see what effect that has on Modern, since both it and Goblin Rabble Master will be Modern legal. maybe we'll see a Goblins deck in Modern now.
No.
I know Robert was playing, or he was trying to play Goblins in Modern, and like he played in a couple small Modern tournaments and did reasonably well, but he kind of lost interest after a while. And I'm hoping that, you know, that'll make him more interested in Modern again because he loves playing tribal decks. And speaking of tribal cards, I'm excited for the number of elves in this set. I have never had the chance to draft a tribal set, and I know that, you know, Origins isn't one by any means, but I'll be curious to see, you know, how draftable elves, like Black Green Elves, is. Because it seems like it has a lot of really interesting pieces, just looking at the spoiler so far.
Yeah, I agree with that. So the cards that I was looking forward to, I actually agree with you about the elves thing, and I didn't know that you missed mutilates. Like, I didn't know that you enjoyed black cards.
Oh yeah, I mean, I don't really wear it on my sleeve, but I do like myself a black board wipe.
Are you closeted, Hallie? Did I just out you?
Maybe, I don't know. I haven't played with Damnation in a really long time.
It feels so good. You don't understand. It's like when someone gives you a really warm hug and then they like rest your head on their shoulder during the hug and they just get all into it. Like, that's how it feels. I know whenever I play Mutilate, there are like two songs that go through my head. The first one is, I wanna know what love is, because that's what love is to me. And then the other feeling that I have is a Madonna, you know, and it feels like home. And you're just wiping the board. That's how it feels. Wiping a board with a blackboard wipe feels like home.
That's wonderful.
I don't know if it's like that with Supreme Verdict, Chris. Is that, do you feel the same way?
Oh, it feels so good. And you can just taste like the salty tears of your opponent when they're like, scoop up all my dudes. That's why I'm like, bye bye, Coco. I ain't worried about you.
So what song corresponds to Supreme Verdict?
Oh God. I'd have to think about this. I'd have to noodle on that a little bit. It'd have to be something very powerful, yet something haughty. I don't know. I'll have to think about it.
I was thinking like Natasha Bedingfield's Unwritten, like so close you could almost taste it. And you're like, you know, after you wipe the board, you're like, yeah, tastes good.
That's exactly it. And they can tell when it's coming too. Like I just even start to tap it and they're just like, pick it all up. It's like, what if it wasn't? What if it wasn't? But it is, just kidding.
Well, it has a very unique mana cost too, where it's like it's what, two white and a blue, and a two, one, two white and a blue. Yeah. So typically, if they see that combination, they're just fucked.
Well, there was one time it was a Narset that I brought out, and instead I just happened to tap like that, and they're like, oh, let me see that a second. I'm like, yeah, go ahead and read it. And they're like, oh, it does that? I gotta do something about that. I'm like, you do.
Yeah, I just remember when I was playing Return to Ravnica Standard, and I was playing against someone who was playing like Wolf Run Bant or like Red White Blue Control or something. It would be like, okay, they don't have double white yet. They don't have double white yet. Damn it!
Yeah, that
I
feeling where you can
know.
tell just by looking at the mana base what's coming.
Yeah.
Another thing that could maybe be like your Supreme Verdict music is that song. I don't know, it's like, I think it's like an 80s song, but it has like that could be like your ending
Oh, the
note.
one from Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
That's what I was just about to say. I was like, oh my God.
I approve. I approve. So yeah, I do agree with you. Elves is fantastic. I would never normally pick up an elves deck, but the fact that there's black elves, I'm all for that. The rare elf that was just spoiled, the Giltleaf Winnower, where when it comes into play, you can destroy a target non-elf creature that has non-matching power and toughness. I am all about that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I would absolutely play black green in standard. Like if it was ever standard viable, I'm in. I'm doubling down on the elves. The other two cards I was excited by are Molten Vortex, which I've been a Lone Pox player for a while, and the number one thing that I constantly get asked is, why don't you play Assault Loam? Why don't you play Seismic Assault? And when you're trying to play Smallpox and Seismic Assault and everything else, it's just too hard on the mana base. But being able to have an effect like that costs one red just to get it on the board, which you're able to do on turn one, you can sneak it past a remand and things like that. That is super efficient. I'm okay paying the one red per activation with Life from the Loam. Oh my god, that's good stuff right there. And the other card, which I feel like was given to me by Wizards as if to say play standard, is the Despoiler of Souls, or as I'm calling it, Horror Bay. So this is two black and it is a horror, and it can't block, it's 3/1, and you can choose to pay two black and exile two other creature cards from your graveyard to return it to the battlefield. This is me. Like, this is Wizards telling me, Aaron, play standard, and I will. Like, this is just everything. And I had people tweeting at me like, this card reminded me of you. So I'm excited. I can't wait to mill this thing and bring it back again and again and again. And it just makes me happy.
Yeah, it's like another riff on the blood gas thing.
I know.
So if Katie's the heat meal, are you going to be Aaron, Despoiler of Souls, Campbell?
I'm okay with that. I will totally be the Despoiler of Souls. I write it down.
I also like the flavor text on that where it's rats and vultures devour, it desecrates. I like that.
I just love everything about it from top to bottom. It's very much me. So lastly, there were some changes that came out this week that they're going to be trying out with Pro Tour Origins to make the experience more enjoyable, not only for the players, but for the viewers as well. And starting with the first change, which is the Mulligan change. And I'm still not really clear as to what this means, so maybe you two can really break it down for me. So if I'm understanding this correctly, they're changing the Mulligan rule, again, only for Pro Tour Magic Origins, and they're saying that when you take a Mulligan, you shuffle your hand back into your library, you draw a new hand with one less card, and then if you decide to keep that hand, you then get to scry one. Is that right?
One of my friends actually has a house rule when we come over to his house to draft his cube that was this exact Mulligan rule. So we were all laughing when the official announcement from Wizards came out.
Okay, but if you decide not to keep the hand, so let's say you mulled a six and you don't like the hand, you don't get to scry.
I would think that you would get to scry for every time you mulligan, but I'm not sure. Like, it sounds a little ambiguous.
Yeah, because it
I'm going to
says,
look at it
okay.
again.
Yeah, it says if a player kept his or her hand, those cards become the player's opening hand, and that player may not take any further mulligans. This process is then repeated until no player takes a mulligan. Then, beginning with the starting player and proceeding in turn order, any player whose opening hand has fewer cards than their starting hand may scry one. So I think you have to actually declare that you're keeping it in order to get the scry.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But okay, so if you mull to six, then if you don't like the six, you throw it back and you mull to five, and then when you declare you're keeping your five, you get to scry one. Okay, that's interesting.
It clears that up in a sentence later. It says the key change is that last sentence. In the event a player takes a mulligan after they finish and have kept their hand, so they're declaring they're keeping it, they may look at the top card of their library and choose to put it on the top or bottom.
Interesting.
Yeah, what do you think about people who, I know specifically there was some concern about Delver players and how this might make Delver, it might give Delver an advantage. Like, do you think that's true?
Oh yeah, I could totally see that. Yeah, if you're, let's see, so if I'm on the play playing Delver, and I scry one, like if there's an instant or sorcery on top of my library and I just go like, if I have like a mana source in my hand, then that, yeah, I don't like that at all. I mean, I'm a Delver player and I think that's totally unfair.
But you'd have to take a mulligan for that, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I've kept six card hands that were pretty decent, or like not quite as good as a seven card hand, but still very capable of winning the game. So I don't know. I guess in that instance, I don't really like it, but I mean, I trust Wizards to make good decisions. Like, there are a lot of decisions they have made that have been controversial, and I think they've usually turned out fine. So I hope that they, you know, ran through that scenario when they were coming up with it.
I'm glad that they're just testing it at the Pro Tour, and it's not going to be like an official thing right now, because I could see it being maybe a little bit of a cluster if you just put it across the board right away, because I think they probably want to see active players playing with this and see what happens. My concern, and I had a friend that voiced the same thing, was people mulliganing to get possible silver bullets, and that I'm not so keen on. If it helps for the reasons that they stated, then I think it works for them. But it seemed like it was more concerning about, you know, for a feature match at the Pro Tour, because didn't they say there was a lot of like non-interactive games? And I wonder, is that coming more from a perspective of people watching and it's not as entertaining? Or are they taking like both players into account and being like, this player, obviously they mulliganed, they're not getting what they need, and it's just, they're just getting decimated?
It brings up an interesting point, you know, these changes as a whole. You know, I had a conversation on Twitter a while back when I was first starting to get in Legacy, and I made a comment about how Sensei's Divining Top is a really powerful card. And I didn't say it had to be banned or anything. It was just one of those cards where I was like, "Woo, this card is a doozy." And somebody brought up why it was banned in Modern for not only being a powerful card, but also for the fact that it was very difficult for coverage. Like, the games ran very long. It was really hard to describe what was happening. Like, it wasn't entertaining for anybody at home to be watching. And then several pros got involved, like BBD, and said, that's not a reason to make bannings. Like, you know, whether or not something is entertaining should not, you know, determine whether or not a card gets banned. And then people like Cedric and Patrick chimed in and were like, no, girl, it has every reason. Like, you know, this is definitely a factor that should be taken into consideration. And it seems like that's where a lot of these changes are coming from. Like, do you think that entertainment value should determine how things are done or whether cards should be banned?
Well, I guess the only thing, with that would be, what about an FNM? What about, you know, even like Grand Prix or PPTQs or something, if you're not the feature match, I mean, I don't know. Universal across the board, I'm just not sure if it would be, I guess, the right answer.
Yeah, like, there's such a small percentage of, you know, when you think about the total number of matches of Magic that are going to be played in that format, such a small percentage of them are going to be used for entertainment value that I'm not sure if that's worth basing your decision on.
Sure, I agree with that. The next change was to judges and video coverage, which we've certainly talked about in previous episodes with regards to, you know, cheating and other instances of shadiness. And it says, in recent months, we've been following feedback, starting with Pro Tour Magic Origins. The head judge can now review video of matches to aid in an investigation of any rules violations that may have occurred during the video coverage for Pro Tours, the World Championship, and the World Magic Cup. The decision whether to use video as part of an investigation rests solely with the head judge. How do you feel about that?
I think it's cool that they can go back now at the time that something is happening and like have the head judge be alerted to it, have them make a decision then, because I can't imagine how long the actual investigative process has to be for Wizards to go back, look at something that happened maybe like a month prior, maybe longer than that, to make some kind of ruling on whether or not someone cheated, whether or not this happened. So I think it's cool that they're listening to what other players are saying about, you know, could this be a thing? Could we use video coverage, you know, and see if that helps with certain areas?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, too.
The most interesting change was the card layout in video coverage. Let's all pour one out for Adrian Sullivan, because He was the one, and people immediately thought of like, oh girl, I'm so
Yeah.
sorry.
Adrian Sullivan got the biggest nerf in this patch.
For those who aren't aware, the change basically says we will be enforcing how players in video feature match areas at professional level events, including Pro Tours Grand Prix, the World Magic Cup, and World Championship, lay out their boards to one specific format. The full details can be found below. Creatures must be in front of lands, and nothing can be behind lands. So no more of this lands in front shenanigans that some of the kids love. The library can be on either side of the play area, left or right. The graveyard must be adjacent to the library. Player can choose which side of play area both are on. The exile zone must be near the library slash graveyard and must be distinct from the graveyard. If a card is exiled by a permanent in play, the exiled card must be placed in proximity to the exiling permanent, like an Oblivion Ring, such that it is obvious that the two are associated, and all untapped cards in play must face the controller of that card. I think this is a good change.
I do too. I definitely like the lands in back, creatures in front thing for coverage, just because so much of modern magic is creature combat based. And when your creature's attacking and the blocking creature is like behind a barricade of lands, it's just so hard to visualize that as a viewer.
Yeah, and Adrian acknowledged a lot of those things in his article that he posted on Star City. He did say something about that being able to look at someone's mana was very telling, and that was part of the reason why that he did it, why other players have done it. I guess I didn't really think of it from that perspective necessarily, but I like when things are consistent enough that if I'm playing someone that I know clearly what things are, because sometimes I'm playing versus someone, I'm like, where is everything? This is all just a pile of mess, and I have no idea where we're at. Like me, I have started taking my graveyard and not putting it under like at the bottom of my deck. I put it to like the left if I'm facing my deck, because I like to make sure that they can see my graveyard clearly. They're not having to necessarily maybe reach over and ask to pick it up or crane their neck around the, back of my deck to see if they can see everything. I know I had some people trying to clarify whether or not those cards were in play, and I'm like, no, I'm just gonna shove them more off to the side, but no, this is my graveyard. This is clearly what's exiled. Because yeah, knowing what your opponent is doing with the graveyard, everything that's exiled, lands, creatures, is very important. And I can only imagine being a first time viewer wanting to watch competitive Magic and being like, I have no idea what's going on here.
Yeah, the only thing I was concerned about, and before, did you see the picture of Adrian Sullivan that he included from like way far back?
I loved it. I was like, oh, little OG Adrian. Got a little spike bracelet on. You go.
I didn't even recognize him. Like he had like long hair and he was like super skinny, and I was like, who's that boy? The only thing I'm concerned about regarding these changes is the graveyard clause, because I'm a Dredge player and we tend to vomit our graveyard out. And that was actually something I was concerned about when I first started playing Legacy Dredge, was when I would goldfish it, because let's face it, you can goldfish Legacy Dredge. I would run out of room. Like I used to just sort of aim it down, like vertically, and then I would run out of room, and I would create a second row, and I'd just sort of take over. And one of my friends was like, maybe you should, go at the top of your play mat. So what I've started doing is I've started laying out my graveyard from left to right at the top of my play mat, making a second row if I need to. And it sounds like I may not be able to do that. And I'm just kind of like, well, where am I supposed to put my graveyard? Because ultimately my graveyard is going to have more cards in it than my library, and I don't know if I can keep it in just this neat little space. It's gonna expand, and I'm interested to see how that goes.
Yeah, and I know some other Legacy Dredge players who do that as well. So it'll be interesting to see how, if any of them reach out to Wizards and like if there are any concessions made for that.
I mean, you could argue that nobody's going to be playing Dredge at a high at a high level tournament, which I think is baloney, and I fully expect to see Dredge on camera at something. I think it's a valid concern.
Yeah,
Fight the
definitely.
power.
Right. Listen, listener question this week. Be sure and send your questions to thegirlfriendbracket@gmail.com. We're actually running out of questions. We had a pretty deep well for a while there, and now we're running low. So please ask us things. They don't have to be related to magic. If you're just looking for advice or you just want to know something about us, we're happy to answer them. And this question we received a while ago, and I wasn't quite sure how to answer it until very recently. And I figured now was a good time to tackle it. So this email is from Rax. R-A-X, and Rax says, "Hi, The Girlfriend Bracket. I am Rax Dillon. I am the player you mentioned in episode 8 as top 16ing in SCG IQ with Affinity. Thank you for the shout out. It was awesome to hear the support, and it inspired me to someday have more exciting finishes for you all to talk about. It was kind of weird to hear you talk about me as a lady and by my wallet name. I signed up as Rax, but I guess my wallet name is tied to my DCI number. I am trans and non-binary and prefer they. Of course, if SCG had listed me that way, you probably would have skimmed right past me. It got me thinking, how can those of us who are read as women but don't identify that way still be supportive of women in the community without being collapsed into being perceived as women or taking up too much space? I've certainly gotten the, ugh, I lost to a girl grossness a few times, and it doubly sucks because I'm thinking, not this game, you didn't, and also, oh my god, how can you have that backward-ass attitude at the same time? I usually end up just kind of letting it slide. One of the reasons I'm not super pushy about being seen as not female is that I know I serve as a role model to a bunch of younger girls and women in my community. I'm also a judge and TO for the Pokemon TCG. I don't want to disappoint them. I want them to be happy and excited about games and safe, but I also want to be a role model to gender non-conforming folks who might be afraid to say anything at all. I would like people to use the right pronoun regardless of role modeling, because really I just want to play cards and have a good time and not get misgendered all over the place. But I don't want that to come at the expense of comfort for women either. I don't know if y'all have thoughts or suggestions, but I would appreciate hearing them, and thank you so much for the podcast. It is one of my favorite magic content things for sure. Thank you."
Well, thank you to Rax for, you know, sending that in, and thank you for, you know, obviously being a great role model and caring about, you know, your community. I guess what I have to say on this front, and, you know, this was not easy for me to answer either. It kind of hit close to home for me. I don't think, you know, we talk about how visibility for women is important. We've talked about that on this podcast. Women who have written articles on women in magic recently have talked about it extensively. And while it obviously is important for, you know, women to see other women doing great things and identify with that, I don't think you need to be a woman in order to be a role model for women. And in order to, you know, support the women in your life and help them be the best at the things they want to do. I think anyone can be a role model for anyone. Just to give an example, at the Lady Planeswalker Society here in Seattle, I would say about 60-65% of our members identify as female. And then there are a whole bunch of other people who are allies, who are still part of the community, supporting those women, and we're all, you know, learning and teaching each other together. And I think, you know, as long as you are a member of the community and you embody the values of that community, you can be supportive of anyone regardless of gender. Plus, you know, Rax brings up that they do want to be a role model for gender non-conforming people, and I think that's a great thing as well. I've had people come up to me in Seattle and ask me what it's like to work with Erin, because they see Erin as a great role model for trans magic players.
Oh god, I'm so sorry.
No, I've gotten like several compliments on your behalf because people think you're doing great work for the community. And I think, you know, if you can be a role model to another group of marginalized people in our community, then that's great. Then they have a representative, then they have visibility. So I think it would be awesome if Rax would, you know, felt that they could, you know, be a role model for several different groups.
Well, I don't know if I can even like have a good follow-up to that, because you pretty much said everything that I was thinking but couldn't like make into a sentence, because when I was reading it, I was like, I don't know if I'm equipped enough to answer this question fully and like appropriately, But I completely agree with you. Rex is definitely already a role model in their community by being a TO, by being supportive to various different people. And I think as long as Rex continues to do that, that they can be a role model for anyone and just try to bring the community together, which is something I've been really big on lately, is, we are different, yet we're the same in certain aspects, but we need to embrace all those differences and, make the community a good place to be.
Yeah, I have several thoughts on this, and I think the first one comes down to the role model aspect. And this is something that you mentioned that people have described me as that, and it's tricky business when you're seen as a role model because you do start to feel like you it supersedes you in a way. You do feel like that you have to remember that your own ability to exist and be safe and be you is much more important than the status of a role model. And that's not to say that I don't appreciate it. That's not to say that I don't welcome it. But a lot of times that word and that phrase gets used to put you in a box. Like, for example, I've had people say to me, well, you're a role model now. You shouldn't be saying that a certain pro player is cute. Or you're a role model now. You shouldn't be wearing that t-shirt. You shouldn't be tweeting that statement. And at the end of the day, you've got to be you. You can't live your life to that. I don't think anybody goes into being a TO, being a pro player, being a podcaster, saying, I want to be a role model. I don't think anybody does that. I think it's something that usually, is given to you and people see you that way. And it's very tricky because, like I said, it is something that people do feel the need to, people may use to control you, or you may even use on yourself. You might guilt yourself into, oh God, I'm a role model now, I shouldn't say this. And it's you just it can be a trap sometimes, and it's very difficult to maneuver through that. The one thing that kept coming up in my mind is that, like I said, you've got to be you. You've got to do what's right for you. And I think as long as you're not, not supporting women, as long as you're not turning your back on that, as long as you're still being as supportive as you were, I don't see anything wrong with correcting people when they misgender you, or when women in your community say, thank you for being a great female role model. You can politely say, if somebody says, I lost to a girl, you can say, I don't identify as female, but I do know several great female players who could kick your butt, Or if somebody approaches you and says, thank you for being a great role model for women, you can say, I don't identify as female, but I have those experiences and I've lived through them and I understand where you're coming from and I support you in what you're doing. It doesn't have to be doesn't that the fact that you don't identify doesn't have to invalidate what you've done and what you'd like to keep doing. I think you can still have both. And I think, like Hallie said, if you can support women and you can also support gender non-binary folks, it's a win-win either way.
Absolutely.
I don't think that you have to choose, or you don't have to shut out one side. And I think you have the potential to do a lot of good. It's just a matter of, and you sound like somebody, Rez, who wants to do good. You don't sound like you've completely turned your back on the gender you don't identify as anymore. I think you're doing great, and you can keep doing great things, and with very little effort. I feel like you don't have to change as much as you think you might have to. All right, so that's about it. Was there anything else on our minds before we wrap up the show?
I guess, as I said earlier, I'm going to be doing a 4th of July stream the day after this episode airs. So if you'd like to watch that, it should be fun. I'm probably going to play Jeskai or maybe do a couple stipulation drafts where I have to pick a red, white, or blue card or something like that. Maybe I'll get Kirby and Uncle Sam hat.
I would love that.
Yeah.
That'd be so cute.
But
I
yeah,
mean,
hopefully I will be doing that sometime on Saturday. Exact time TBA, but I'll announce it on Twitter before it happens.
all right. So if anybody's enjoyed the show, where can they find you all? How can they get a hold of you?
So I'm Hallie. You can find me on Twitter and Twitch at HalCanSan. That's HalCanSan. You can send me an email at hcsmtg@gmail.com, and you can read my articles here on gatheringmagic.com.
And I'm Chris. My Twitter is THKRIZ. That's to Chris. My Gmail is YOTEHKRIZ. KRIZ. That's Yo to Chris. My Tumblr is also to Chris. And I recently made a Magic Online username. So if you would like to be friends on Magic Online and help me kind of get acquainted to that, feel free to send me a DM with a request to be friends. Thanks.
And I'm Erin. You can find me on Twitter at Original Estrus. That's OriginalOestrus. You can email me personally at estrus@elitistjerks.com. The show is on Twitter at the GF Bracket. You can find us first and foremost every Friday morning at gatheringmagic.com. And you can email us at thegirlfriendbracket@gmail.com. Thank you all so much for listening. Next week, Katie will be back along with our very special guest, who I'm sure you will all love. And please take care of yourselves, okay? Bye-bye.
Bye.